KRWG News this week, I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. After the El Paso massacre, there were hopes for new gun safety legislation. Instead, Texas legislators weakened state law, allowing people to carry handguns without a background check or training starting next month. And Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick used the word invasion to describe migration, the same term used by the alleged shooter accused of killing 23 people in El Paso 2 years ago. In depth, here's KTEP's Angela Kocherga.
Water gently cascades from two fountains at El Paso's new Healing Garden, where 23 Italian cypress trees represent each of the victims of the mass shooting.
Every tree was planted by one of the family members.
El Paso County Judge Ricardo Samaniego walks me through the garden. A former psychologist, Samaniego's been involved in all the painstaking details, including the shape.
Circular, so that it would be like a hug.
Samaniego hopes the garden will help visitors find the strength to move forward.
It's a place that reminds you, you know, they should never die in vain. What is it that I could do to make things more transformational?
Action and results.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott promised change immediately after the 2019 mass shooting. He convened a series of roundtable meetings of the Texas Safety Commission to tackle several critical issues.
They include combating threats of domestic terrorism. They include rooting out hateful ideologies. And they include keeping guns out of the hands of deranged individuals while at the very same time making sure that we can do so in a way that safeguards Second Amendment rights.
Yet 2 years later, domestic terrorism and hate-fueled violence is on the rise, according to the FBI. Gun rights have been expanded, including a law going into effect September 1st that'll allow Texans to carry handguns without a permit. And then there's the messaging from Republican state leaders. At a recent news conference where Governor Abbott announced he plans to build a Texas border wall, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick said this.
We are being invaded. That term has been used in the past, but it's never been more true.
That's the exact term used by the alleged El Paso Walmart gunman. Dina Marks, Senior Associate Director for the Anti-Defamation League Southwest Region, says words have consequences.
And we need our leaders to lead and call out hate whenever it arises, not to divide and stoke more fear with hateful words.
The governor's office declined an interview request, citing his busy schedule at this time. El Paso Congresswoman Veronica Escobar, a Democrat, says the governor failed to lead following the mass shooting.
Not only has he not done anything, but we've gone in the opposite direction, the more dangerous direction, on so many fronts.
And Escobar says she's seen the consequences firsthand.
In El Paso, during the August 3rd domestic terrorist attack, and being literally inside the Capitol as terrorists surrounded us on January 6th, there is absolutely a through line there.
El Paso County Judge Ricardo Samaniego also sees similarities in the angry mob that descended on the Capitol and the lone gunman who drove to El Paso.
It was a narrative that he picked up that felt that he had to act on. How different is that from January the 6th? They pick up the narrative, they think they're going to defend the country in that particular way with anger and, you know, ugliness as a way to solve I don't know what.
Adria Gonzalez survived the wrath of the Walmart gunman. She was inside the store shopping with her mother during the attack. She fears it can happen again.
It could be that it can be repeated, but that's why we can't forget. We can't forget that morning. We can't forget those 23 victims.
As El Paso remembers, throughout the country, there's a renewed call to action to prevent other cities from experiencing the same heartache and hate crime violence. I'm Angela Kocherga in El Paso.
After 2 years, there is no trial date for the North Texas man accused of killing those 23 people. Patrick Crucius is also facing federal murder and hate crime charges. A federal hearing was recently moved to mid-November. No date has been set for the federal trial either. El Paso County District Attorney Yvonne Rosales says the pandemic has delayed most jury trials.
We hope that we will be able to keep this case in El Paso. We are still seeking the death penalty. My trial team has been working very diligently on this case for the last 6 months, and we will continue to do so until we are told we have our trial date.
And Rosales did not take any questions during the press conference where she announced the latest on trial preparations. As COVID-19 cases rise in much of the country, new data from the CDC shows the Delta variant may be as contagious as chickenpox. Dr. Edward Michelson is chief of emergency medicine at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso and serves on the city's COVID-19 task force. Anthony Moreno talked with Dr. Michelson recently about what the community needs to be aware of with this more contagious variant.
Dr. Michelson, thank you so much for joining us for the program. What is it about the Delta variant of COVID-19 that concerns you the most?
Well, first, thanks for inviting me to join you today and to have a chance to speak with your audience. Delta variant is basically all that we're talking about right now for a couple of reasons. First, it is the predominant strain in the United States. We've heard about Alpha, Beta, Gamma, and now Delta, and each variant seems to be getting worse compared to the earlier ones. By their nature, viruses tend to mutate, and they mutate in some instances to forms that are less contagious or less virulent, and those die off. But those mutations that are more easily spread, meaning that they infect more readily, that they replicate more quickly, have an advantage, if you will, a competitive advantage compared to other versions of the same virus, and they tend to take over the colony. And that's what we're seeing in the U.S. We're now in the Southwest region, we're at least 80% Delta variants in new cases of COVID. Another reason that it's of concern is because we have evidence that it replicates approximately 1,000-fold more than the version of COVID we were dealing with this time last year. So that makes it much more easily spread between individuals. The third problem with Delta is that our current vaccines are only partially effective against Delta. They benefit us by keeping most of us out of the hospital if we happen to get infected with Delta, and that's a good thing. But people may become infected with Delta and have minimal symptoms and not even realize it, which means that they could very easily spread it to other individuals in the community.
You were one of the first in our region to recommend that everyone, even fully vaccinated people, wear masks indoors and in crowded places. What was it that you saw that was really concerning?
Well, I hope people listen to my advice. My recommendations are devoid of any politics. I think, unfortunately, that our federal officials and some state officials have to weigh the political ramifications of what they say against the best public health information that we have. And fortunately, I'm not under that restriction. I've been tracking COVID cases now for well over a year, and I was watching the rise of Delta in this country and seeing it growing very quickly. And we know from other areas that our vaccine, as good as it is not as good against the Delta variant. So we know that there's still a risk of transmission, even for those fully vaccinated. And I think, truthfully, the government didn't want to send the message to people that were vaccinated that it was time to go back to wearing a mask, because one of the rewards, if you will, one of the benefits that they used to get us to get the vaccine was you would no longer need your mask. That advice was true before Delta. We were well enough protected before the Delta variant that really was the case. But as Delta rose, I saw the inevitable, that it would continue to rise and it would start spreading among those who were vaccinated. So that's really the reason for the advice.
Are you seeing a change, any change with demographics? Are younger people getting infected and hospitalized with this virus?
Yes. So the answer is yes. I'm definitely seeing younger individuals coming in with COVID. If you look at the breakdown of ages of those testing positive, there's been a big increase in the 18 to 30-year-old range. I suspect there are quite a few cases of COVID in the younger population, in the teens, the 12s to 18s. And we know that that group hasn't had the availability of the vaccine for as long as the rest of us. And we know some parents have been reluctant to get their kids vaccinated. And I'm predicting we're going to see a big spread of the Delta variant among school-age children as soon as the schools reopen, just because of the close proximity of the kids, and because many of the kids may have minimal symptoms and be spreading COVID and not realizing it. So we have seen an increase in younger people diagnosed with COVID. I would say people being hospitalized, it's trending towards a younger age, and part of the reason for that is that a good 86% of those over age 65 are vaccinated.
Dr. Edward Michelson is chair of emergency medicine at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. He's also a member of the regional COVID-19 task force. I want to thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Michelson.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm really glad to have the opportunity to get the message out and to be able to encourage folks to not give up, and if they're not vaccinated, get vaccinated.
And of course, stay tuned to KRWG for the most comprehensive coverage of the pandemic. You'll find updates every day at the region's homepage, krwg.org. And there is more in this program on this story as well. Las Cruces Public Schools announced a mandatory mask requirement for the upcoming school year this week. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
Las Cruces Public Schools Superintendent Ralph Ramos announced district mask requirements for the start of the 2021-2022 school year, noting the district will continue to monitor state public health orders and make adjustments accordingly.
All LCPS students and staff will be required to wear masks indoor during the school day and during after-school indoor events.
Stephen Lopez from the Office of Emergency Management told the board his biggest concern is the rate at which COVID hospitalizations are growing across the state, increasing from fewer than 100 COVID patients to approximately 180 in the past 2 weeks. Lopez says that while the vaccine is helping to keep the case count lower than the spring and symptoms mild, the Delta variant still poses a risk to the LCPS community.
We are now seeing with the Delta variant a large number of vaccinated people having what we call breakthrough cases. Fortunately, the vast majority of those are no symptoms or mild symptoms, but it does mean they have the potential to spread to others, even though they are fully vaccinated.
Original proposed district guidelines did not require vaccinated middle and high school students to wear masks indoors. In accordance with guidelines from the New Mexico Public Education Department, newly appointed LCPS board member Pamela Court advocated for the district to make the mask requirement a uniform policy for every education level.
It seems to me that we could just be proactive and require everyone to wear a mask and do our part in our society, in our district, to slow the spread. It makes it more equitable on a middle school and a high school level because then, you know, there are just the issues with those who are wearing masks and those who don't, and makes it easier for everyone.
The new mask requirement does not extend to the outdoors. LCPS students will be allowed to go maskless for structured outdoor classes such as PE. One public commenter voiced concern about implementing a mask policy, questioning the effectiveness of masking elementary school children.
I don't know if you've noticed any kids wearing masks, but they are constantly touching their face, and then they're touching everything else. They're taking their masks off, putting them on their wrists, or putting them in their pockets, handling it with their hands and putting them back on, and then often not even washing their hands afterwards. This is not going to help stop the spread.
LCPS Board President Ray Jaramillo called on district stakeholders to come together, saying that COVID-safe practices are the best chance for an uninterrupted education.
I ask the community to come together as a community and come together so we can get our children back in school. And whether that be getting a vaccination, which I encourage, or wearing your mask, is no longer a political will anymore. We've gone beyond the political will. let's choose another time to argue about some other stuff. Let's really come together.
LCPS board member Maria Flores stressed the importance of following state and federal guidelines, saying every member of the LCPS community must work together to keep students healthy.
It's about responsibility. Each of us is responsible in our own way of making sure that we are healthy and that our students are healthy. So if it starts at home, and then when that responsibility isn't followed through, it burdens the schools, it burdens the school nurses. On the other hand, I trust our principals and our assistant principals with making sure that things run right in their school. And I think as parents, that's what we need to do, is let them do what they know how to do.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Falsehoods about COVID-19 and the COVID-19 vaccinations has led to a new bill in Congress. It raises the issue of government censorship of social media when bad information is being spread like wildfire. Some thoughts from commentator Walt Rubel.
One of the few things Republicans and Democrats seem to agree on in our divided nation is a desire to restrict speech on the internet. Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act of 1996 has become a favorite target for partisans on both sides. The provision states that owners of an internet platform, quote, shall not be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information, unquote, posted on their site. Republicans want to see the provision rescinded because they believe conservative voices, including that of former President Donald Trump, are being censored. Democrats want to see it rescinded because they believe it shields those who profit from the spread of misinformation. And to that end, newly elected Senator Ben Ray Lujan of New Mexico has signed on to a bill by Senator Amy Klobuchar that would strip internet platforms of their Section 230 protections when it comes to information about health care. The bill would further politicize healthcare by making the Secretary of Health and Human Services responsible for reviewing all related contents on the internet and determining which ones contain misinformation and which ones don't. Like all cabinet positions, the Secretary of HHS answers to the President and is responsible for helping to advance the administration's agenda. Anything challenging that agenda could be labeled as misinformation. Does anybody think current HHS Secretary Javier Becerra and Trump administration Secretary Alex Azar would agree on which comments should be removed? When asked how they would establish an algorithm that would precisely detect misinformation while still allowing for skeptical debate, Lujan said he hadn't looked into that yet. Klobuchar, Lujan, and others supporting this bill are responding to the understandable frustration many of us share regarding low vaccination rates in several areas of the country. I fear that problem will be resolved through death and illness, but I'm certain it cannot be fixed through internet censorship by government officials loyal to the current administration. We should do all we can to encourage trusted sources to counter misinformation with facts. But we'll never be able to stop people from spreading lies and rumors. That said, none of the above should be seen as a defense of Section 230. Internet platforms have become the dominant publishers of our day. Their influence is now far stronger than that of traditional media. It makes no sense to hold them to a lower standard. Internet platforms have established business models that profit from stirring our passions and allowing us to find like-minded people to confirm our darkest instincts. They've done irreparable damage in an incredibly short amount of time. Section 230 should be scrapped entirely, and all publishers should face the same level of liability for the content they disseminate. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
Walt Rubel's opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of KRWG or NMSU. KRWG News this week, I'm Fred Martino. It's great to be with you. A historic West Texas schoolhouse that dates to the era of racial segregation could become a National Historic Site under a new proposal in Congress. Republican Senator John Cornyn and GOP House Rep Tony Gonzalez introduced two similar bills to make the Blackwell School in Marfa, Texas, part of the National Parks System. The school served Marfa's Latino students from the early 1900s through 1965 because they were not allowed into the same schools as their white peers. Gonzalez says that history does not get talked about enough.
Look, when people talk about segregation, they don't talk about Hispanics. So I think highlighting something like this would be an eye-opener to many people.
A similar bill filed by Gonzalez's predecessor Will Hurd never went anywhere, but supporters say they're feeling better this time around now that the plan is before both chambers of Congress. The DACA program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, hit another legal snag when a federal judge ruled the Obama administration had created it illegally. The decision means no new DACA applications will be accepted. KERA's Stella Chavez reports on the devastating impact of the decision.
It was near the end of the workday when U.S. District Judge Andrew Hannon issued his decision on DACA. Edna Yang's phone started blowing up. Texts, phone calls, emails.
I think it was best put by one of the clients who contacted me and said, I feel like I've been punched in the gut. I was expecting to get this great benefit and to be able to make some plans for my life. And now everything's on hold again with all of this uncertainty.
Yang is co-executive director of American Gateways. The Austin-based nonprofit organization provides legal services and advocates for low-income immigrants in Central Texas. Many of her group's clients have gone through a seesaw of emotions for the past several years. Last summer, the Supreme Court ruled against the Trump administration, which sought to end DACA. That gave some people hope. Jeremy McKinney with the American Immigration Lawyers Association says these numerous legal battles over DACA are precisely why Congress needs to act on a permanent solution.
I would love it if somehow the public discourse could switch from DACA back to the DREAM Act, because that's really where the conversation needs to be.
McKinney says he and others will continue to defend DACA.
And we're going to continue getting this type of temporary respite for our clients. But at the end of the day, it's temporary. It's a Band-Aid. We need a permanent fix.
McKinney says the problem is how DACA was implemented. As Judge Hannon cites in his ruling, the Obama administration didn't go through the formal rulemaking process known as the Administrative Procedure Act when DACA was created in 2012. McKinney recalls his colleague's reaction when DACA was first implemented.
A lot of individuals in our membership within the American Immigration Lawyers Association at the time were perplexed that the Obama administration did not go through the APA rulemaking process to avoid litigation.
The DACA suit Judge Hannon ruled on was brought by Texas and eight other states in 2018. It argues that it costs states money to educate DACA recipients or provide medical services and assistance or issue a driver's license. Yang with American Gateways says research actually shows the opposite effect.
That all of the states who joined in this lawsuit have actually benefited. They've benefited economically from Dreamers and their families, from DACA, from individuals paying higher taxes, from individuals being employed in their states, from bringing business to the states.
According to the New American Economy, a bipartisan research and advocacy group, DACA recipients and DACA-eligible immigrant workers are vital to the economy. In Texas, nearly 62,000 DACA-eligible immigrants are essential healthcare workers, and 480,000 are essential non-healthcare workers in industries like restaurants, construction, and supermarkets. Yang says she's heard some employers are frustrated by this latest court decision.
I do know that other employers anecdotally have said, like, you know, well, I was planning on hiring, you know, these other folks, and now I can't because, you know, I was relying on them being able to get their work permit via DACA.
So now, what happens next? Jeremy McKinney says,
it's pretty complicated, but it boils down to three things. The courts can fix this situation. the executive branch through the APA process can fix the situation, but fundamentally the permanent solution lies in Congress's hands.
In March, the House passed the so-called Dream and Promise Act with bipartisan support, but it remains to be seen what will happen in the Senate and whether a permanent fix will ever happen. I'm Stella Chavez in Dallas.
To environmental news now, and concerns are being raised about a proposed takeover of New Mexico's largest utility, PNM, by the out-of-state firm Avangrid. The New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown reports Avangrid has had reliability issues in Maine.
Maine resident and utility consultant William Dunn says outages force him to rely on a generator at least four times a year.
We've seen here in Maine, since our local utilities have been taken over by others, service has gone down, both in terms of reliability and customer satisfaction, and costs have gone up.
Public comment on the merger is scheduled via Zoom on August 9th before New Mexico's Public Regulation Commission, and the hearing involving expert testimony will continue August 11th through the 20th. PNM says the merger could maximize use of the state's renewable energy sources, such as solar and wind. A recent survey by the group Electrical Construction and Maintenance shows Maine has the most frequent power outages in the U.S. Maine resident Sophie Galkin was only 7 years old when Avangrid's power supply failed one winter, causing her home's sump pump also to fail. Now 25, Galkin says she's never forgotten watching her widowed mother haul buckets of water from the basement for 8 hours to protect her home and children.
Quite frankly, I think they really don't care about what anyone wants or what happens to them. So, like, I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemies, and especially the good people of New Mexico.
Dunn says it's concerning to think New Mexico residents could experience what he and his neighbors in Maine have endured if Avangrid gains a foothold in the state.
If what happened here happens there, with the goal to funnel as much money to Avangrid that they will make investments where they earn the most money, not necessarily where it provides the best customer service.
Despite touting renewable energy, data show Avangrid and its parent company, Spain's Iberdrola, generate significantly more gas and nuclear power than renewables. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
Well, we are hearing more and more about climate change, but one issue that is often ignored is the quality of our soil. KUNM's Zaylee Pollan has more.
Hardly a day goes by without a terrifying reminder that the Earth's climate is in crisis. The Southwest is in a mega drought and fires are erupting around the West. But there are people working to stop climate change, including many here in New Mexico. I spoke with Santa Fe photographer Esha Kiokio, who has created the Good Earth Project. It documents agriculturalists throughout the state who are battling climate change by regenerating soils. Here's Esha.
I wanted to tell the story of solutions to our land, to our people, to the future of humanity. We have to make some significant changes if we are going to survive.
So tell me about soils. Why that focus and why are soils so important?
There have been studies recently that say that globally we have about 60 growing seasons left in our soils. And I don't know about you, but I have kids, and I would like to see our soils last longer than 60 growing seasons. The more I learned about soil as a climate solution, the more convinced I became that this really is one of our best mechanisms for kind of revitalizing this planet on many levels. Soil is the foundation of life. It is the most essential thing that we have. It's our most precious commodity. It's how we grow our food. It's how wildlife thrives. It adds to the diversity of this planet.
So you worked with radio host Mary Charlotte DeMondi, who did the interviews, and you created 8 short, and I should say truly stunning videos and a host of photographs. So give me a little bit more detail about each of the subjects that you interviewed.
Thule's Trees is a native and drought-tolerant tree specialist, and his whole philosophy is no bare ground. Contour the land for optimal water retention, cultivate diverse, regionally appropriate species, and encourage beneficial insects, birds, and bats to frequent the land. The next one is the Rain Catcher, a permaculture design and landscaping company in Santa Fe. And I love Rhys Baker's quote. He says, humans could literally be the secret to the restoration of the earth instead of the virus. The only principle you need to do is harvest the water, start to grow soil. Everything will come from that, especially in the desert. Horned Locust Goatscaping, they are regenerating landscapes with goats. So it's just a brilliant use of animal power in our urban landscapes. The next one I focused on is Reunity Resources, and they are diverting food waste, building compost, creating a farmer's market, hosting a food truck, feeding the hungry. They really exemplify a closed-loop community food system.
I know you also spoke with Santa Ana Pueblo, which is focusing on land restoration as a way to bring wildlife back. There's North Valley Organics in Albuquerque, and they grow two crops, a cash crop and another dedicated to soil microbes. Then in Las Cruces, a soil microbiologist is collaborating with a pecan farmer to transform their 30-year-old conventional pecan farm into an organic one, using cover crops and integrated livestock. These projects are really amazing, and it does seem an important time to be telling their stories.
I think this is critical for people to understand not only the farmers, but also the people who are buying their food. Everyone who eats needs to know this, because we have so many health problems throughout this country, many of which have been proven to be linked to these pesticides and herbicides. We're voting with our dollars, right? And so the food we buy not only can help shift the entire society from conventional agriculture to organic agriculture, but it also improves your own health.
You're continuing to work with one of your subjects, Gordon Tooley, who was asked by the state to basically reseed and create a grassland along a strip of I-10 near Lordsburg. There, the dust storms are so bad they're the cause of 29 fatal car accidents. So he's creating these divots to kind of mimic buffalo hooves, right?
Each one of these pockets can hold a gallon of water. So when the rains do come, all of that water can go straight to work rebuilding the grasslands that we have lost over this past 100 years.
To see all 8 of Kiyokio's videos, go to kunm.org. You can also find information on the New Mexico Healthy Soils Grant. This funded Kiyokio's work and also has funding for farmers who are interested in rehabilitating their own soils. For KUNM, I'm Zaylee Pollan.
Well, from our soil quality to our quality of life, some people are saying there's a lot of noise pollution, there's a lot of emission of pollutants, just a nuisance, period, in Las Cruces due to UTVs. There's been so much concern about this. There is a proposed permitting resolution, but there's also a lot of controversy about it, too. So much, in fact, that the Las Cruces City Council this week voted to table the proposed permits. In-depth, Madison Staten has our report.
A resolution to establish a $15 UTV permit application fee was unanimously tabled by the Las Cruces City Council, following pushback from councilors advocating for larger fees and increased regulation. Councilor Tessa Beda-Stuvi, who voiced support for a $50 flat fee, says $15 is not enough to cover the cost of city services associated with increased UTV use.
I would recommend us looking into a scale that is a little bit different. We're also going to have probably repairs on roads. I know I am getting some unfortunate individuals who are saying that there's a lot of trash or litter that are around some of these heavily used areas. And so looking for the future with all of that, I would suggest a bit larger of a permit fee.
Las Cruces Police Department Deputy Chief Paul Brock broke down how the department came to the proposed fee, noting the amount is predominantly based on the salary rate of LCPD officers conducting UTV inspections.
I estimate it'd take about a half hour to complete the UTV inspection, and then the cost of the sticker itself, which is minimal.
The resolution is in response to a March 2020 ordinance allowing UTV vehicles on paved city streets. While amended last summer to include a requirement for a permit, the city will have to set a permit application fee before the requirement can be enforced. Councilor Gil Sorg says the 2020 ordinance has led to a disturbance of peace in many city neighborhoods.
I'm just going to say it out loud. I'm not even in favor of this pyramid. I'm in favor of repealing the ordinance altogether. I've been getting constant complaints from residential people having these vehicles go through their neighborhood, disturbing the peace. I take it that these people that have these vehicles are just taking advantage of our goodwill to allow them to drive on our city streets. So I can't see supporting even having these vehicles on our city streets.
Between 2019 and 2020, LCPD, UTV, and ATV-related calls increased by 64%. The increased activity is something Councillor Yvonne Flores has noticed, commenting on areas where she has seen congestion.
I'm in agreement that there is definitely a problem with the UTV, and there's a lot of problems with ATVs too. I've seen those going down Loman and blocking traffic between Loman and Telshore, that stretch right there, and very happily just riding along. But I'm not sure about the enforcement.
Councillor Gabe Vasquez says that while more needs to be done to quell reckless use, he wants Las Cruces to embrace responsible members of the UTV community, suggesting an online etiquette course be required to obtain a permit.
I think folks should have to take a safety course or some type of etiquette course before getting their permit, right? To say, not just on city streets, but even when you are going to use these vehicles in the intended areas, things not to do, right? Like, that you should know not to do, like not cutting illegal roads on public land, like picking up after yourself, leaving no trace when you're on public land, making sure if you're driving that you're not driving through neighborhoods at 1 a.m. with a very loud exhaust system. Some, you know, considerations so that there's an educational component to the permit requirement.
City staff is in the process of preparing a new resolution proposal that will address both the permit fee increase and the addition of an etiquette course. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
And Madison will have the latest on the city council. They meet every week, and she is on duty. She'll have that Tuesday on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. KRWG News this week, I'm Fred Martino. It's great to be with you. On the Health Watch this week, for hospital workers, a fourth wave of the pandemic means it's the fourth time they're dealing with a surge in cases and despair. Houston Public Media's Sarah Willa Ernst asked Avery Taylor of Houston Methodist Hospital's Highly Infectious Disease Unit, does it feel different this time around?
You know, the first couple rounds, it was chaotic and frantic, but there was a lot of energy from healthcare providers. We felt like this was really meaningful work that we were doing. These people needed our help. That's not the feeling this time around. This time around feels like we're walking in just to like a cave of needless suffering. These patients don't need to be in hospital beds. We have a magic bullet and we're not taking it.
Are you saying that because the majority of people ending up in the hospital now for COVID are unvaccinated?
Yeah, so that's the really hard part about this is we've recommended everybody in our lives get vaccinated. The statistics don't lie. 98% of patients in Methodist hospitals right now are not vaccinated.
So with you and your team of nurses, what's the general attitude in your unit now?
So general attitude is of frustration. You know, obviously we got into healthcare to take care of people. We want to help people. But we're having to do some mental gymnastics to really like dig down and find our compassion right now. You know, I feel very committed that any patient ends up in our beds, we are going to take care of and take care of well. But I spend Sunday at church just crying through the service because I'm so sad and I'm so frustrated that there are going to be people who, you know, suffer and die when they don't have to. And I don't know at this point what else to say or like how to appeal to people's emotions or their logical brains to change their minds and to get vaccinated. I honestly was in denial like all of last week, even as I've been like hiring nurses and like opening the second unit, I was thinking, oh, it's just a spike from 4th of July. Like surely this is not what we're doing again. And like each day the numbers went up and went up. And I guess denial is a great coping mechanism because I finally realized like, oh gosh, like we're really doing this again.
So what do you do to take care of yourself and for people in your unit, for people to take care of each other?
Yeah, so this week's been pretty busy. I can't say that I've done a very good job taking care of myself. But overall, a lot of my staff have started going to therapy, including me. And actually, it is not unusual for my staff to say something about, like, well, my therapist says, which I think is great. We're also, like, reading books together. We have a book the title is The Four Agreements. Reading that together has calmed a lot of anxiety. It's brought us a lot of peace. Like, it's helped us communicate with each other better. So that's been nice.
Even with all these efforts to, like you said, normalize talking about mental health, and I know Methodist has made mental health care more accessible for y'all, do you feel like it's made a measurable change? Or do you feel like even that's not enough?
I mean, no, like, it's only enough if you use it. But I know my nurses are hurting. I know that I'm hurting. We don't want to do this again. But I also know that, like, we will. But I think my biggest concern is, like, at what cost? And I don't think anybody has answers for that yet. I think only time's going to tell us how many nurses end up leaving the profession. I want to think that it's not going to be anybody, but I'm sure that will end up happening.
Don't forget our healthcare workers. They are indeed heroes during this very difficult time across the globe. That was Avery Taylor of Houston Methodist Hospital speaking with Sarah Willa Ernst. To Texas politics now, and the Texas Democrats who remain in Washington, D.C. to block Texas GOP voting restrictions from passing got some reinforcements this week. The Texas Democrats getting support from many, including Lucy Baines Johnson, the daughter of the late President Lyndon B. Johnson, who praised their efforts at a rally this week.
They were unable to build consensus in our legislature for the right to vote, although God knows they tried. So they courageously came to D.C. to protect that right.
She was fired up, and she's not alone. This week, dozens of lawmakers from other states joined the stand in Washington, D.C. for federal voting rights legislation. Meanwhile, at the Texas Capitol, Republicans like State Representative Greg Bonin say the GOP bill will ensure voter confidence.
It should be easy to vote and hard to cheat, which is exactly what House Bill 3 does.
Stay with KRWG News and NPR for the very latest on the controversies in Texas politics. Well, Texas lawmakers are considering changes to the bail system that would make it harder for nonprofits to get people out of jail. That bill, like the voting restrictions, on hold as Democrats stay in Washington, D.C. to prevent a quorum. Houston Public Media's Jen Rice has our report.
When Tanya Galvan spent 3 months in a Houston jail this year, she says she felt hopeless.
I'm thinking about my grandkids. Like, this is not where I'm supposed to be at. I'm supposed to be out to be able to help with my family, my grandchildren.
She was charged with assault in a family dispute and held on $15,000 bond. She couldn't afford to get out. When she learned about the nonprofit organization, the Bail Project, and they put up the money for her, Galvan was floored.
They don't know me from Adam, but they're willing to put the faith in me enough to do this.
Now, Texas lawmakers are considering a measure to limit charitable bail funds by restricting who they're allowed to help. That means in the future, the Bail Project may not be able to help someone in Galvan's shoes, or someone like Hervis Rogers, the man accused of voting illegally. This month, at a hearing at the Texas Capitol, State Senator Joan Huffman, a Houston Republican, said the goal of the legislation they're working on is to keep habitual and violent offenders in jail.
It's not going to lead to mass incarceration. Instead, it should keep those who need to be in jail so that our citizens can go about their everyday activities on the streets of Texas.
But State Representative Joe Moody, an El Paso Democrat, said the bill would likely keep others in jail too, like Rogers. During the 2020 presidential primary, Rogers stayed in line past midnight waiting to vote at Texas Southern University. He is now facing charges of voting illegally. He was still on parole when he voted.
Under this bill, because he has felony convictions in his past, a charitable bail organization couldn't help Mr. Rogers. He didn't commit a crime of violence here. He unknowingly voted.
State Attorney General Ken Paxton's office is prosecuting the voting case and held Rogers on a $100,000 bond. Paxton himself is currently out on $35,000 bond while awaiting trial on securities fraud charges. Rogers' attorney, Andre Segura, with the ACLU of Texas, says Rogers didn't have the money.
He still spent three nights in jail, but if it weren't for charitable funds, he could have spent a long time there.
Segura has asked Rogers not to give interviews yet because of the complexities in his case. The Bail Project CEO, Robin Steinberg, says when she heard about Rogers' case, they immediately stepped in.
I would argue that any kind of cash bail would be outrageous in Mr. Rogers' situation, but the idea that somebody was at $100,000 bail was literally obscene.
In fact, Steinberg argues the measure at the state legislature isn't even about public safety, it's about punishment.
It's an example of how cash bail can criminalize poverty.
Steinberg also points out the proposed limitations wouldn't apply to the for-profit bail bond industry. That means a low-income person charged with a violent offense couldn't go to a charitable organization to bail them out, but they could still go to a bail bondsman. As for Tanya Galvan, the woman helped by the Bail Project, she's hoping others will get the same chance she got.
These people give you the opportunity of knowing, hey, you do have another chance, but you also have to put in the work too.
The Texas Senate has already passed the bill. The House hasn't yet voted on the measure because most House Democrats have left the state for Washington, D.C., hoping to stop Republican lawmakers from passing a controversial voting bill. In Houston, I'm Jen Rice.
Arts and entertainment now, and at a recent meeting with the Las Cruces City Council, the Arts and Cultural District was discussed. Emily Guerra spoke to Doña Ana Arts Council Executive Director Greg Smith. He is also the chair of the Arts and Cultural District Coordinating Council.
Tell me more about the Arts and Cultural District. Is that a new organization?
Well, it's relatively new. We've been trying to have an Arts and Cultural District in Las Cruces for, way back about 12 years ago when I was on the Downtown Las Cruces Partnership. But they finally pulled all together, and the city accepted it as a plan and as an organization in 2018. So we have an Arts and Cultural District, and to help the city and the Downtown Las Cruces Partnership with projects in that Arts and Cultural District, there's a coordinating council that serves as a committee under the Downtown Las Cruces Partnership. And we are continuing to work on signage and gateways and those kinds of things. Also had a really exciting meeting at the City Council with their TID board, the Tax Increment Development District board, in last part of July. And what they did was they emphasized the importance of the Amador Hotel. And so there's going to be $1.3 million directed towards more of the work that needs to be done there. Unfortunately, there's still even more work, but that's an important iconic feature. And so that's one of the assets in the Arts and Cultural District. So I was very pleased to see the City Council get behind support for that. The other thing is that they put a pause on the shade structure for the plaza. We all know how hot our summer days can be, but we also know that the Plaza de las Cruces is an important feature in the center of the Arts and Cultural District and a very destination type of place for events and things like that. So we asked, and they looked at it from the standpoint of taking a little more time to look at maybe how shade could be integrated there or if shade was needed. So we appreciated them putting a pause on that. But those kinds of things, gateways, work on Klein Park, those are the kinds of things that we've been working on with the City of Las Cruces and Downtown Las Cruces Partnership to sort of make the history and the culture and the art of our downtown area pop.
Now with some of the things that are opening up due to COVID, how is that affecting the Doña Ana Arts Council?
Well, we have been in our new location at 250 West Amador for almost a year now. We moved in September of 2020. And at that point, we basically went to come in, if you're going to wear your mask, please, feel free to come in. We're keeping social distancing, that sort of stuff. And so as the months have gone by, we've relaxed some of those rules. And now, of course, our rule is that if you're vaccinated, it's your choice as to whether or not to wear a mask. But we're looking at what the recent guidelines from the CDC have been saying and looking at, okay, how do we back up a little little bit and exercise a little more caution. But we have been open, we've been working there, and we've had a few people come in almost every single day to look at what's in the gallery and to see some of the other things that we have going on.
And how has that affected other galleries and museums in Las Cruces?
Well, the city of Las Cruces has just recently reopened their museums. At first, it was by reservation only, and then it was back to general public being allowed in. So that has had an impact there. And certainly with other galleries, of course, them being private enterprises, they can do what they feel is comfortable for them. But I think it's had a huge impact just across the board as far as some businesses not being able to stay in business and others exercising a great deal of caution and moving along slowly.
And what about the artists? How has that affected them economically?
Well, it's been a huge impact. I mean, we had an artist relief fund going at the Arts Council for a number of months, and we had private donations. This was not from our general fund, but private donations that came in from individuals who put money with the Arts Council to distribute as $100 grants to artists who requested it. The artists who got that money said it was a huge help to them. Some used it for groceries. Some used it for supplies. We didn't put any constraints on how they used it, but it was very clear to us that this was very meaningful and important to a number of our artists. And in general, obviously there are some artists who have adjusted to the online type of thing very well, but there are others who are still struggling with that. So it has had an impact. And certainly performing arts have just taken a huge hit.
You can hear more of that interview with Greg Smith under Puentes. You'll find it in the news tab at krwg.org. Finally this week, one of those stories that may have gotten overlooked by other media organizations, not KRWG. We are going to continue to bring you the latest on legislation in Congress and locally. And this is an important one. Wildlife experts say about one-third of all wildlife species in the U.S. are in decline or vulnerable, which makes revived legislation in Congress critical. The New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown reports the Recovering America's Wildlife Act was introduced in Congress by several legislators, including New Mexico U.S. Senator Martin Heinrich.
Whether you grow up in New Mexico or you grow up in Missouri, you remember that first fish you ever catch. You remember the monarch butterflies in your backyard and all of these species that are just not as common as they used to be.
If passed, the conservation work could be paid for through royalties from resource extraction on public lands. Heinrich notes that during the pandemic, more Americans visited the outdoors than ever before. Ken Lucero is tribal administrator for the Zio Pueblo in north-central New Mexico. He says both big game and small game have been essential to the tribe's survival, providing food, clothing, and other needs.
But unfortunately, we have seen a significant decrease in both game species and biodiversity on our lands and the neighboring communities. We understand that unless we address the dwindling populations, there will not be any wildlife for our future generations.
The legislation would give the state's Department of Game and Fish $28 million annually to help conserve 235 species in need. Jesse Dubell directs the New Mexico Wildlife Federation and says it would also benefit the state's outdoor recreation industry.
The more wildlife and the more species of wildlife that a visitor is likely to see, the more likely that visitor is going to come to New Mexico and spend their money in our state.
National Wildlife Federation research shows more than 150 species already are extinct and 500 more haven't been sighted in decades. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
That's KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces, and KRXG Silver City. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.